saving money on your next project now at Menards. Don't let an outdated garage door define your home. Revamp your home's appearance with a new Ideal Garage Door. Choose from our large in-stock selection or design your own using our free Garage Door Designer. Hurry in and save big money on your next project. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. I am really excited to invite you to join myself and friend of the podcast, Cara Lissett, for a live webinar on the 19th of March at 6 p.m. We will be talking all about the links between eating disorders and bipolar, focusing on Cara's lived experience of this. These webinars are for anyone, whether you're struggling yourself, supporting someone, or a healthcare professional looking to understand more. The understanding of how conditions interact can sometimes be misunderstood, but we are here to help you support your patients and better your understanding through sharing real life experiences. We are so grateful to all clinicians who do such incredible work and want to help you to help us further. If you would like to come along to the workshop, please follow the link in the show notes to sign up today. I would really, really love to see you there and enhance the work that we do as Full of Beans and grow our community further. In this week's episode, I am joined by Fiona Hollings, or Fee, as a lot of people know her. Fee is autistic and has almost recovered from anorexia. She spent a lot of her youth battling with her mental health and anorexia, experiencing treatment that wasn't adapted for autistic people and spending a lot of years healing the wounds that that inflicted. She's now passionate about raising awareness of the overlap between autism and eating disorders and how treatment can be adapted for autistic people and how to use the strengths of being autistic to overcome an eating disorder. Absolutely loved recording this podcast. You can hear our energy. We are on the same wavelength. We are so connected. It's fantastic. And I'm so happy because this week is Neurodiversity Celebration Week. And, you know, I don't want to negate the fact that neurodiversity can come with challenges. It can feel overwhelming. It can feel difficult. Like, God, I have got the t-shirt for that. But equally, it can be liberating. It can be freeing when you get your diagnosis. It can allow you to understand so much about you and yourself that you didn't before. And as Fiona and I both talk about, it can really help just kind of set you free in your recovery and realize that you don't need an eating disorder to navigate life anymore. So I really, really hope you enjoy this episode and look forward to hearing from you if you've had a similar experience. It is so lovely to have you on the podcast. It's so funny when this kind of thing happens because I feel like I already know you and we've actually never spoken. It's just been like Instagram interactions. And I think it's just so funny the way that the world works now.
It is. It makes a very large world feel a little bit smaller and more connected in a way. I've listened to the podcast for a long time now, so it feels always a little bit strange when you're like featuring on something that you like regularly listen to.
Yeah.
So I think when I get the little notification saying this has gone out and it'll be my name, I'll be like, oh, that's me.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. Well, thank you very much for listening to the podcast. That really means a lot. So for the listeners, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yep. So I am Fiona Hollings, or Fee, as most people know me. I am autistic and have almost completely recovered from anorexia. I am passionate about speaking about autism specifically, but also the overlap between autism and eating disorders. based on my experiences and things that I've gone through, but it's such an important topic that needs more understanding, needs a lot more action. So that's kind of my area of passion.
Amazing. Yeah. And I think, like you say, it's something that's so important to be talking about. And it's, you know, I've had a lot of conversations with people where they've had similar experiences to you, you know, been struggling with an eating disorder along the road. They've then been diagnosed with neurodiversity and they're like, maybe if I'd known about that, that might have been helpful.
Yeah,
would you like to explain a bit? And, you know, I don't want you to say to you like, oh, just tell me your life story in 30 seconds. But yeah, to explain a little bit about your journey with an eating disorder and then autism as well.
So I have struggled with my mental health for an awfully long time. And many of those difficulties that I experienced, especially when I was younger, I now know were related to being undiagnosed autistic. And I'd say my mental health difficulties peaked when I moved into high school. So that transition from junior school to high school was not good for me. I always think, like, certainly high school then was not a fun place to be as an autistic person on a sensory level, let alone the complexities of the social interaction, friendships, gossip, all of that kind of stuff. And then the academic pressure as well. And I developed anorexia when I was 14. I got very poorly very quickly. I think a lot of people kind of go downhill quite slowly and it kind of develops over a number of years. I was kind of healthy and like had a semi-normal relationship with food in the summer, and like 4 months later I was in a crisis intervention for the eating disorder. It was very confusing. I didn't really understand what was going on, and I was absolutely terrified. I didn't really understand kind of what was happening or anything like that, and I initially went through very standard eating disorder treatment. You know, I had CBTE, saw a dietitian, and I found it incredibly difficult to engage. I found therapy, it was utterly bemusing. I had no idea what I was feeling, had no vocabulary for my emotions. I struggled to know what I was feeling physically. I struggled with meal plan changes that were being asked to me, but it wasn't, like, looking back, it wasn't actually adding more foods I was finding difficult. It was adding lots of new foods, but we can come back to that another time. So I initially went through treatment and I really struggled to engage. I was still hugely struggling with my mental health difficulties along with the eating disorder. And I think that was very much, everything was just, oh, you've got an eating disorder and that's why you're struggling. And they kind of said, you know, you'll weight restore and you'll get better from the eating disorder and all these things will get better. And I kind of always used to think, but they've been there actually for longer than the eating disorder has. And I guess I always found it really, it scared me because I was like, what happens if I don't have the eating disorder, which in a way felt like it was actually helping all of the things that I was struggling with. And then I thought, I don't have that and I'm going to be in an, you know, still struggling with my mental health. I'd say I went around in circles for a number of years. I had lots of different treatment styles and nothing was working. And I felt broken. I felt like, I think like growing up, I felt broken anyway. I felt odd. I didn't fit in. I didn't, you know, I just hated myself. And then throughout my teenage years, I ended up going around these cycles of, you know, trying to get better, struggling, getting worse again, and being told that I was, you know, being non-compliant and difficult and complex. And I wasn't. I was struggling and the treatment wasn't being adapted in the way that I needed it to be adapted for being autistic. So autism had mentioned a couple of times during kind of my journey, but I'd very quickly dismissed it because I had a sort of an idea of what autism was in my head and that wasn't me. So I was quite kind of like, no. And actually it was when I started university and I started, you know, reading more kind of journal articles and things like that, that I started understanding autism a little bit better. And I finally read, you know, books and blog posts, and it was like, this is me. This makes sense. And all of the difficulties that I have faced my whole life, but especially during that, like since I developed anorexia, were so easily explained with an autism understanding. In true autistic style, I wrote my psychiatrist a 12-page letter detailing all the things that I had noticed and had been pointed out to me over the years that would make sense if I was autistic. And my psychiatrist didn't even finish the letter before she said, yes, this is highly likely you're autistic. And she referred me for an assessment. And we spoke about, I don't know if you're aware of the waiting lists for autism assessments. And we spoke about, like, do we go privately? Because I was still really struggling at this point. And we spoke about going privately. Obviously, it's very expensive. And we kind of thought, what would I get from bringing forward a diagnosis? And we decided that I would get an understanding, yes, but we would probably do things slightly differently because we'd know I was autistic. And it was actually my mum or my dad, and they said, well, why don't we just do those things differently now, because who you are and what you struggle with is not going to change based on whether or not someone says yes, you are autistic or you're not. So from that day, we decided to start making adjustments based on a suspected autism diagnosis. And so, you know, when I actually did go on and get my official autism diagnosis, not a lot changed externally in my life at that point, because we'd made all these changes. And actually, because we made them from the point of referral, not waiting for that official diagnosis, I was doing really well. My treatment had changed for autism, but also, like, it was more me and how I was managing my daily life and how my family and friends understood me better. And I finally started making solid progress in my recovery, because I just understood myself. And over the years, I can't believe it's actually been years now, I've started, you know, speaking more about, when I first autism was brought up, I kind of remember whispering to my mum, like, I think I might be autistic. And now I'm like, I'm autistic, you know? And I realize that it's something that I don't need to be ashamed about. It's not a bad thing. It explains why I feel different, and different doesn't mean wrong. And that's what my psychiatrist said when I had the autism assessment. She said, there's nothing wrong with you. You're autistic. And I had that on a piece of paper just next to me on my desk. But it was in that moment that I was like, I thought I was wrong for such a long time. Then treatment told me I was wrong because I was getting treatment wrong. And I wasn't wrong. I'm just different. So I feel like I've massively rambled there. But does that kind of answer a little bit about me and my journey? And I hope not too much detail, because, God, that could get very boring and very messy. But I guess that's the essence of really struggling, developing anorexia, really struggling for a long time still, and with anorexia, realized I was autistic, and things have slowly gotten better. You know, it wasn't like I realized I was autistic and I took a pill and everything was fine. I still, you know, am working through difficulties. I still have my challenges, but I am currently in the best place I've ever been in my entire life, and that feels strange.
It's so lovely to hear. And as you were speaking, I don't know, I just was kind of getting so emotional myself, because our story is so incredibly similar, which is so wonderful, in the fact of I was also diagnosed when I was 14, and, you know, went through years and years of treatment of this is not working, I'm not working, I'm wrong, like the things that they're giving to me are not working and that's my fault. And actually, only literally like 5 hours ago was I having a conversation. I went to a networking meeting this morning, and when I first started networking, I kind of I went back into my Hannah shell. I was like, no, I can't be the Hannah that I now am, that I've now created. I have to, in the professional world, I have to be different. And I now don't do that. And I found myself saying to somebody, like, you know, openly just saying, I'm ADHD, like I'm autistic ADHD. And I was like, oh my God, why did I say that? We then had a conversation around mental health and things like that. And she said, what was it for you? Why did you need the diagnosis? And that was the question I wanted to ask you, not in the sense of, like, oh, well, why did you need the diagnosis? Because I think that's what a lot of people do say in that tone. I'm really interested because when she asked me, I was like, I don't know. It just gave me compassion for myself, for everything that I've ever bullied myself about. I no longer had that. And I wondered what your perspective was, because you said, you know, obviously, we still struggle.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's still very hard, but getting that autism diagnosis, it's almost, I don't know, for me, it felt like something had just lifted.
Yeah. I think for me it was, I mean, you've so eloquently described it there. It's something shifting, and it's really difficult to kind of quantify or say this is what it was, but it was like I beat myself up so much and for so long for being who I was. And it was a vicious cycle that was, quite frankly, making my recovery near impossible, making my eating disorder a lot worse, making my mental health terrible. And I was interpreting all these events that were happening around me. So treatment not working, and, you know, why can other people do it and I can't? Like, what is it about me? I must be broken. And I think when I realized I was autistic, I was like, I am nothing but horrible to myself because of the way I am. And for me, it did bring this element of compassion in, where I was like, well, I'm trying to be like everyone else and I'm not. And I need to stop that. Like, I need to just be kind of like, no, this is me and I'm okay and I'm enough. And I'm not saying that I suddenly was like, I loved myself or anything like that, but it reduced that critical voice I had in my head that was just this constant, what is wrong with you? Why are you wrong? Why can't you do this? You know, why? And you know, within my eating disorder recovery, yes, why can't I, why can other people recover and I just can't seem to do it that way? And why does my recovery not look the same? But also in my life, why do I get so tired? Why do I, you know, when you said you step back into your Hannah shell, like I used to go to events, like, you know, just family events, and I'd want to be like my cousins and talk to people and catch up with people, and I'd freeze because I struggle in those situations. I struggle in big groups of people, and there was this distance between who I am and what I am capable of and what I was demanding of myself. And I was demanding myself to be a neurotypical person, and I'm not. I do struggle with certain things, but I also excel in certain things. And actually, it's funny that you say, it's one of the first things that you said is, you know, I'm ADHD and autistic. Is it's something now that, because I'm able to say, yeah, I'm autistic, it's, I guess, my way of saying to people, I might engage with you a little bit differently, but trust me, I'm still here for it. Like, I'm still here for you. And I'm wanting to be part of this conversation. And sometimes I want to caveat it by saying, if it looks like I'm not listening, I am listening. I just listen best when I'm not looking at you. Mm-hmm. And that's really difficult to say to people. But sometimes just saying, by the way, I'm autistic. People are starting to get it and understand. yeah, a weight lifted, something clicking. Okay. There's so many ways that you can and can't kind of quantify it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it changed things. It did.
Yeah. I think, and I don't know whether you might found this as well, but for me, it was like finally having access to a community that I felt that were almost not similar to me, but just kind of were on the same wavelength as me, on the same frequency. And I actually realized when I got diagnosed, I started thinking about all my friends and I was like, everyone's neurodivergent. Like, why did we not realize this before? But it was only then when I got diagnosed, I was like, oh, that actually makes quite a lot of sense. Like, obviously we've been attracted to each other because of those similarities and the way that our brains work. But then it's almost as though because you finally have that, oh, like I can be myself. I don't need to kind of hide anymore. When you're in those communities of people that are also neurodivergent, you know, it's amazing to connect with those people. But as you also say, when you're in, you know, environments with people that are neurotypical, you can also, and I mean, I guess what I want to caveat this with is that this is not how I felt immediately when I got diagnosed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, this has taken a while to then have the confidence to be able to walk into a room and say, I'm autistic ADHD. But something I really wanted to ask you about was, because you said that when you got diagnosed, you know, obviously there were still difficulties with treatment and recovery. And I don't want us to kind of, you know, it's amazing. And when I can see how much the diagnosis has helped us both so much. But when you said that when you got diagnosed, you then thought, okay, well, I don't actually need, sorry, when you had the realization, you thought, I don't need to wait until I get diagnosed to start, you know, making amendments or what have you. What sort of things did you start to implement into your recovery that were different to what you'd done before?
The first thing is just having a plan. For me, my plan is my lifeline. So we started because I always wanted to be this super spontaneous person. I think I looked at other people and thought that's the way to live. And
spontaneity is so cool and amazing, and everyone
and we want to suddenly jump on a plane and go to a different country, and you know, we want to just see how we feel. I don't understand that. See how I feel in what respect? I don't understand that. And I know that I always felt at my most comfortable, and when I felt comfortable, I did better in my recovery. Is when I had, say, a week of structure and routine. And this, you know, when I was at university, it was brilliant because your week is structured for you. And I noticed these patterns where when I had that structure and routine, I did really well. So I implemented that first off. I started planning my day. And then, so I do this every Sunday, I plan my upcoming week. So I plan in, you know, what I'm going to be doing at different points. And that actually enabled me to do more, because I'd notice if I had a lot on one day, I would schedule in downtime. I know that that's really important for me to prevent that burnout and stop trying to be like neurotypical people who apparently can go every single day all the time. I can't do that. That's okay. So planning, definitely. And I use that in my recovery. So I plan in like recovery focused things, but I'd also use non-recovery planning that kind of fed into my recovery. So like planning, seeing my wonderful neurodivergent friends, which I totally, totally understand you on that one. I think the more I reflect on everyone I've ever properly connected with in my life, they are almost all neurodivergent. So, you know, planning in and seeing them and being around people that I don't need to mask around is really important. Learning to unmask, that has taken and is still taking years. But starting to use things like my noise cancelling headphones when I'm overwhelmed. One of the most important things that I did in my recovery, so I have always been incredibly sensitive to noise. That is what I'd always say is my biggest sensory processing difficulty. And when I am very overstimulated with noise, so less one big noise, but lots of complicated noises. I find that incredibly overwhelming. I go into fight or flight. And when I'm in fight or flight mode, eating is incredibly difficult. So just thinking about the environment that I was having my meals and snacks in, making sure that either it was calm and quiet, or if it wasn't because I was out or something like that, taking my noise cancelling headphones, using my loops, little things like that made a big difference. Another thing that changed, I guess, in my treatment was moving away from this idea of constantly needing to have lots of new foods and new dishes. I actually didn't have the biggest problem with adding more food in. I've always wanted to be well. Like, that is something, the moment I got unwell, I was like, this is awful. I don't want to be like this, and I want to be well. I guess I always struggled a lot with changing things to make things better. And one of those things that was asked of me when I was going through treatment initially was adding in all of this, you know, spontaneous eating and new foods and all that kind of stuff. And it wasn't working because I've never eaten like that. So instead, my treatment very much focused on the non-negotiables being there has to be enough food, but actually less pressure on there being this huge variety of food, and having that priority of enough food with the knowledge that variety will come. It will just take more time. That took a big pressure off. And I think when the pressure came off, it meant that I was able to do better with my food. And actually, I'm doing a lot better with variety these days. I wouldn't say I'm ever eating like the biggest variety of food, but I'm quite proud of myself for some of the things I've managed to try. But I knew that that had to come from me. The moment I feel pressured, I kind of shut off and I get very overwhelmed. So I guess those were kind of the things that were implemented quite quickly. I think the biggest one for me was that structure, the routine, knowing when I was doing things and knowing when I wasn't doing things. Both of those equally important.
And I can completely resonate that with that. I think whenever there's uncertainty, that's when I notice that things kind of start to slip a little bit. And I think, you know, it's difficult because in the ideal world, you can have your life planned and you can have every meal planned and your days planned, and that's fine. But then sometimes there are curveballs. And I suppose, I guess this is a question I have for you, because this is one I've always found I've never really known the answer to, in that something like an eating disorder, we want to recover from. Like, we want to get to a point where, I mean, whatever, you know, recovery looks different for everybody, but whatever your vision of recovery is, you want to get to that point. However, with autism, it's not something that you're going to recover from. It's something that I see that you develop coping mechanisms that allow you to thrive in life alongside your autism. And you recognize that sometimes there'll be challenges, sometimes there'll be great things that your autism, you know, enhances you to do. So how did you balance that in terms of recognizing this is my eating disorder, therefore I need to challenge this, or this is the autism and actually I need to be gentle with this, I need to find a coping mechanism for this?
It is so difficult. You know, I worked in this area, and it's the question that comes up all the time, like, how do you differentiate between the two? And I'd say I'm at a place now where I'm able to differentiate them only through time and practice, because some of these things, it is like, why do I do it that way? What is driving that? And it is difficult. And I think especially in the early stages of recovery, when someone's brain is acutely malnourished, like, there is such an overlap between autistic traits. I think there was a fantastic quote, and it said that autism and anorexia is like autism on steroids. So it's that idea that a lot of the autistic traits might be heightened even further by acute malnutrition, you know, in the brain. I think it's, for me, it's very much been a case of looking back over what was I like before the eating disorder came in? What kind of foods did I eat then? What kind of foods did I not eat then? What was I kind of like in who I am? So, like, for example, I'm quite an active person. I've always been, like, I require quite a lot of stimulation, I guess, from exercise and just being active in general. So I knew that for me, activity was quite an important part of my recovery. But I also needed to make sure that the eating disorder wasn't hijacking it and going, oh, you're really active, you should be active. So it was one of those things where it was like, okay, so it's a goal for me. Right now it's not feasible, but it's a goal for me because I know it's important to me. The same with food. Like, what kind of foods did I eat before getting poorly? I grew up on pasta. Pasta, breakfast, lunch and dinner. That was my it's a brilliant dish. It can be versatile. But that was my dish, you know. I used to eat, that was my autism safe food. So I knew that if I was avoiding pasta, that was an eating disorder thing. That was not an autism thing. So it did take looking back over my life, but you know, also these things change. Like I said, like I have added more variety into my sort of my like repertoire recently, and they're things that I wouldn't have even touched when I was younger because they looked different. And you know, a lot of my sensory issues around food were it doesn't look okay, so I wouldn't even try it. And I think it can be a bit of trial and error sometimes. Like, it can be, where do I always sit with it? If there is a really valid reason that I'm not, yeah, it's questioning the reasoning behind it. If it's causing anxiety because I think, you know, there's something kind of about the food that is, I'm scared about, like, what happens if the texture's not right? Like, what happens if there's, for me.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
An unexpected texture will absolutely bamboozle my brain. So that really puts me off actually a lot of fruit and vegetables because they're a bit unpredictable. Pasta's not. So things like that, it's kind of questioning, like, where's the anxiety coming from? Like, I did, I was on the Christine McGuinness Unmasking My Autism documentary, and something she said to me really stuck with me. She said, did anyone ever ask you what is wrong with the food? And I said, no. Like, I've been going through eating disorder treatment for this long, and actually no one ever said to me, what's the issue with the food? Like, why are you struggling with that food? Like, where's this panic coming from? And sometimes, absolutely valid, it was an eating disorder panic. Like, it scares me because I've not touched that food for a long time because it's scary. But also a lot of the times is those two things are touching and I can't cope with them touching. You know, those two different textures. Or like, for me, I really struggle with very hot and very cold things being next to each other, like ice cream and brownie. I had no issue if it was served in separate bowls. I would eat it. But together, nah. So I think a lot of this, it's come through time. It's come through questioning things. A lot of self-questioning. I'm much better at questioning things myself than someone asking me necessarily. I feel quite like, I don't know, worried if someone asks me about it. Mm-hmm. Like, if, you know, I sat down with something and they kind of, what's wrong with it? I'm like, okay, you know, don't ask me in the situation of the food. But it's something that I've explored a lot in my head and kind of gone, okay, so that could be autism, that could be eating disorder, and you can't fully unpick them. You know, I always say, I am autistic and I'm in recovery from an eating disorder. They will overlap. But autism is who I am. That's the way my brain works. That's not going to change. But the eating disorder, I will absolutely fully recover from. So it's just learning about what bits do I need to recover from versus what bits do I need to work with. So I always say, work with the autism to help overcome the eating disorder. That's like my number one go-to.
I love that. I really, really like that. I think that's, I'm actually going to write that down. I think that's such a good phrase for it. But it's when I first kind of, you know, before I'd even been diagnosed myself, I'd had conversations with people that were autistic and also had an eating disorder. And I used to think, oh, you know, I bet you'd kind of just have to be really honest with yourself and like look deep. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, I don't even think it's about honesty. I think it is just about, I mean, it is about honesty, because, you know, if it's the eating disorder driving it and you're like, oh no, it's because I'm autistic all the time, then I guess you could naturally fall into using that as an excuse. But actually really being honest with yourself, sitting down and evaluating everything of like you said, why am I finding this difficult? Is it because the sensory issues with it? Is it because I've not eaten this food for years? Is it actually because I'm terrified of the calories in it? Like, what's the actual driver? Yeah. And I think, as well as with the food aspect of it, I completely resonate with that on an exercise level as well. And that, I think for me, my biggest thing hasn't been recovery from the food. I on reflection, found my journey really interesting, because I say I didn't have an issue with the food. My therapist would absolutely argue I had an issue with food, but to me, that didn't seem like the biggest thing. My issue's always been the exercise. And as I've worked through it more and more, I'm like, I understand why. Because, for example, this week, I am not able to do like cardio exercise because I burnt my hand. And the doctor was like, you can't, because it's like second degree burn and it needs to heal, blah, blah, blah. And I found it really difficult. But I've not found it difficult from a perspective of not burning calories, which is what it used to be. Now it's been the perspective of my brain has so much energy and I need to get this out. But where this week's actually been such a nice reflection is going for a walk and chatting to a friend has been just as stimulating as what I thought like a really intense cardio workout would be. So I think basically what my long-winded ramble there was, we're all so unique. And even if, you know, you've been diagnosed with autism, somebody else's reasons for struggling with food and an eating disorder could potentially be different. And that very nicely brings me on to the work that you've done with the Peace Pathway. And I'd love to hear more about, you know, your experience, how you were involved with that, and then kind of, you know, what the implications have been on that for people with eating disorders and autism and their treatment.
Yeah, so I mean, Peace for me started out being a bit of a savior in that it gave me so much information about obviously what I was experiencing. And then I inadvertently ended up working for them, which was just absolutely, you know, I was kind of talk about putting purpose to the pain that I've been through. And I'm not an angry person. I'm really not an angry person at all. Sometimes I question if I should be a bit more angry, but I'm just not. I'm kind of like, you know, what's happened's happened, and there's not a lot I can do about what I've been through, but what I can do is hopefully either stop someone else going through the same thing, or speaking about what I'm going through might help someone else go, hang on, that's how I feel. And then they don't feel as alone, or they understand where they can go for more resources or anything like that. So I started, I was actually researching something for my degree, and I stumbled across Peace, and just everything I was reading, I was like, this is just absolute gold in the world of autism and eating disorders. And I didn't know anything really existed about this specific overlap. And I ended up speaking to Professor Chanturia, who leads it in the Maudsley in London. And she invited me to speak at her conference in about 2 months from when I first made contact. So I spoke at two of her conferences initially. And then quite fortuitously, they extended the Peace Pathway to around where I live. And it was the first, it was being extended into CAMHS. So that's where I worked for the last 3+ years. It's been absolutely incredible being part of something that has been so innovative and so aware of what needs to improve and get better for people who are autistic. And it's just so forward thinking. The team I worked with, the Peace team, I will never be able to replicate that feeling of just kindness, community, passion. It was just absolutely just fantastic. And we rolled out the Peace Pathway for children and adolescents around here. And so we helped write whole therapeutic interventions. We spoke at conferences. We did a lot of training, answered clinicians' questions, and started a Peace website for resources. Anyone looking to further understand autism and eating disorders, the Peace website, I cannot recommend you go and look at it. It has three different sections. If you're looking for resources, it's got some for someone who is autistic and has an eating disorder. It's got resources for parents and carers, and it's got resources for professionals. And these are things like communication passports and sensory profile sheets and information and signposting. And just, I think that the work that Peace do it's needed. It's so needed. And it is going all across the country now. So I'm currently doing some stuff with EDAC, which is in Edinburgh, which is eating disorders and autism, comorbidity. And it's kind of the Peace Pathway, but spreading up there as well. So one of those things that we want to spread. yeah, I think it's been absolutely incredible being part of something that is changing other people's lives. And we were getting feedback about, you know, the stuff that we were doing and de-escalating situations that would have otherwise gone into hospitals and inpatient units. You know, parents feeding back that they've never seen their child interacting and engaging with their treatment team like they did after these Peace interventions were made and Peace clinicians were, you know, put within the eating disorder teams and things like that. And I think to be part of something like that is just, yeah.
So is it training for clinicians, or is it a specific kind of protocol that's included in someone's treatment plan? How kind of, what is the intervention itself?
I mean, it was so diverse. It was so, like, there were Peace clinicians, so they could get involved in individual cases. They could also kind of do recommendations based on sort of cases that were brought to their attention. There was training, so I delivered a number of CPD slots, so continued professional development slots, answering clinician questions about, you know, they kind of be like, I've got this patient, don't really know what to do. And I'd be like, well, have you thought about doing it this way? We started a young people's participation group, so other young people who are autistic and have an eating disorder offering their suggestions and opinions and experiences. A parental support group, experience group was also set up. And then just a lot of kind of, I guess you could say, clinical recommendations were kind of brought together and then given to different teams. So just thinking about things like the sensory environment, different communication styles, and like differences in sort of interaction and how it's very diverse. And I think that's why I'm struggling to give an answer.
But I, do you know what? I'm actually really glad, because if you kind of turned up and you said to me, oh yeah, so we put together this package for people that are autistic and basically you do this, this, this. And I'd be like, oh, well, I think that's kind of missed the whole point of the fact that every single person who is autistic will be so different and will need such a different approach. And do you know what? I actually think, and I think I've said this for a few weeks, probably months on the podcast, in that it's not just people that are neurodivergent. You know, if people are neurotypical, everybody's got different things going on in their lives. They've got different issues. They've got, you know, different kind of exciting things in their life, different relationships, you know, and we need to really get to the core of that in order to then treat somebody. So I think, you know, the Peace Pathway is absolutely brilliant for understanding things, you know, from an autistic perspective and how you can support somebody and adapt their treatment. But then actually, I think that the approach there can then be used universally for treatment, because for me, that's one of the biggest issues I have with eating disorder treatment is that it's not individualized. And, you know, you turn up with an anorexia diagnosis, therefore you get anorexia treatment. Okay, cool. But it might be, you know, the nice guidelines, it might be the gold standard, you know, perfect treatment. But then what am I supposed to do if I don't respond to that? So I love this approach of really, you know, thinking, you know, the clinicians bringing questions to you, thinking about different patients and how they're responding and adapting. And, you know, those kind of things need to be ongoing as well, because one week something might work perfectly, the next week it's absolutely not working at all. So it's brilliant.
There's a really lovely study that was done in the Maudsley in London, and they found that making the PEACE adaptations in their inpatient unit benefited the autistic people, or possibly autistic people, those with high autistic traits, and the patients who were also not autistic. Mm-hmm. And you know what? I think you use the word individualized, and that's, I recently did a talk to a part of the UK, and I said a lot of these things, that yes, they can be considered adaptations for autism, but at the end of the day it's individualized care. And I think the issue with eating disorder treatment is it's become so fixed in, someone has a diagnosis of, say, anorexia, they're put on this anorexia treatment path, and if it doesn't work, then that person is clearly not either trying hard enough, or it's not, you know, but, you know, there's nothing. And it's like, no, like, you've got an individual who has their own set of their own history, their own set of difficulties, their own set of strengths, different family dynamics, different academic dynamics, everything. And that needs to be considered in their treatment. And, you know, I have never hugely struggled with body image issues, so doing body image work was kind of, it felt meaningless. And actually what I needed to really work on is my sense of self and trying to accept myself for who I was, which would have been great to do that work then. And also with the knowledge that I was autistic, that probably would have saved me quite a few years of pain. But didn't happen. But I hope it does. I hope it starts happening now, where we're kind of going, we've got someone and we need to think about how treatment can help them rather than how we can fit them into our treatment.
I love that. Make treatment work for you, not you work for treatment. Yeah. I think that's a brilliant synopsis. Thank you so much for chatting. Do you know what's really lovely is that I didn't even realise, I won't lie, that it was Neurodiversity Celebration Week in a couple of weeks. And then I realised, like, yesterday, and I was like, oh, that's great that we're doing this podcast. And actually, like, this has been such a celebration of both of our experiences. So I think it aligns so wonderfully with that. So thank you so much for coming on and chatting to me. Where can people go to find out more about you?
So I'm probably most on my Instagram, which is finding_fee_.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for all the work that you do as well. It sounds absolutely incredible. And it's been such a pleasure.
Only repeat it back to you, because everything that you're doing is brilliant, absolutely fantastic. You really are
a powerhouse of a podcast, this one.
Definitely.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.